I think in any vibrant, ongoing discipline, questioning it has to be at the heart of it, or there's no growth. It's equilibrial. It's stable. And stable, by the way, is death. In any complex adaptive system that we know about, from our mind to life to evolution to technology, what you want is constant, perpetual disequilibrium. Mm. You're almost always falling over. When you're walking, you're almost always falling and catching yourself. And so that disequilibrial state, and I think questioning is intellectually is the same kind of thing. Mm. You wants to be slightly off balance. The questioning is what keeps it perpetually off balanced. You question your own assumptions, you question your own reasons for being, you question your own existence, you question everything, and that makes it slightly off balance, and that off balance becomes the main event. That is the life force. That is the self-creating loop.
Albert Einstein said, "Don't think about why you question, simply don't stop questioning." Welcome to Curated Questions. I am your host, Ken Woodward. And these questions are not mathematical equations, but rather a resource to encounter personal reflection and growth. As Tupac Shakur stated, even the genius asks questions. Now, let's engage the questioning community.
Greetings, Ken Woodward here. Welcome back to another episode of Curated Questions. Together, we engage inquisitive humans about how they use questions to navigate and make sense of our world. I am a fellow traveler and pilgrim on this journey, and I'm glad you are here. As we get started, please take 3 seconds to hit the follow or subscribe button on your podcast player. This makes all the difference to the algorithms, as it lets them know you find this podcast worthy of discovery by new listeners, and you will be notified of the newly available episodes for your listening pleasure. Thank you. Now, on to the show. Today's conversation is with Kevin Kelly. Kevin is one of the most original voices in technology and culture. Kevin's career is a journey through the heart of innovation. He helped launch Wired magazine, shaping how we understand the digital revolution. Before that, he edited the Whole Earth Review, spotlighting trends like virtual reality and online communities before they entered the mainstream. He co-founded Well, one of the earliest online communities, and the Hackers Conference, bringing together the brightest minds in tech. His books, including What Technology Wants and The Inevitable, challenge us to see technology as a living system, one that evolves alongside us, shaping our lives and choices. Through his Cool Tools project, Kevin champions practical tools that empower individuals, while his work with the Long Now Foundation pushes us to think on a grander, multi-generational scale, like 10,000-year kind of scale. Whether chronicling disappearing cultures in Asia or exploring the emotional bonds we form with machines, Kevin brings relentless curiosity and optimism to every subject. Kevin, welcome to Curated Questions.
I do like to start things off in just kind of setting intention. And so my question for you is, when did you first understand the power of questions?
I haven't been asked that before.
Yes.
I think I first realized the power of asking questions by watching closely someone who I consider a mentor to me, who was Stuart Brand, the legendary founder of the Whole Earth Catalog, who had several remarkable qualities. Among them was his uncanny ability to never repeat himself, to talk about the same things over and over again with new words each time, over 50 years. So if you asked him about the Whole Earth Catalog, he would describe it in a way that he'd never described before after 50 years of trying to describe it. But he also had this remarkable ability to ask really interesting questions. And I think that was when I began to see what happens when you had an interesting question. It just enlivened the entire room or conversation in ways that I hadn't ever seen before or appreciated. So I became interested in sort of like, can I do that? Can that's something that you can learn? Mm-hmm. And I think right. it is something that you can learn.
Yeah.
So I saw the power in action. And I think later on, I began maybe to think about it in more conceptual terms, but I first encountered it in real life in a person who was really good at it.
Hmm. I just love it. And I know that you've, that relationship continues on. So, wow, 50 years of that kind of relationship has just got to be a staggering.
Yeah.
How do questions function differently between Eastern versus Western intellectual traditions?
I don't think I have a good understanding of that. I know that there's sort of the Greek Socratic method. I'm not sure how that compared to the, say, Chinese or Japanese koans. I would say that they're both a part of the tradition. The Jesuits, too, were famous for their questioning. And I know that in a curious way, Descartes' famous, I think, therefore I am, is actually not a good translation of what it was really about. It was, I question, therefore I am. That if you look at the actual setup for what he was saying, it was the fact that he had questions about his existence meant that he existed. So questioning is fundamental, but I truthfully haven't done that kind of a scholarly comparison. I've given you anything I had just now.
That's beautiful. And then any tie back to indigenous cultures? Because I know you've touched with those on as well.
I think in any vibrant, ongoing discipline, I think questioning has to be at the heart of it, or there's no growth. It's equilibrium. It's stable. And stable, by the way, is death, right? In any complex adaptive system that we know about, from our mind to life to evolution to technology, what you want is constant, perpetual disequilibrium. You're almost always falling over. When you're walking, you're almost always falling and catching yourself. And that we know that, like, atmospheres and things, if they are in equilibrium, they're dead. The reason why Earth is so special and we can identify it from millions of miles away is that the chemistry in it is in disequilibrium. There's way too much oxygen in our atmosphere because it would just burn up everything. But it's being constantly replenished, and so it's constantly offsetting. It's being maintained in this disequilibrial state. And the same thing with life. It should just collapse, but it keeps going into that disequilibrial state. And I think questioning is intellectually is the same kind of thing. You wants to be slightly off balance. The questioning is what keeps it perpetually off balanced. You question your own assumptions, you question your own reasons for being, you question your own existence, you question everything, and that makes it slightly off balance, and that off balance becomes the main event. That is the life force. That is the self-creating loop, that off balance that you get with questioning in a system of knowledge and communication where you are challenging the course, challenging the system in some ways.
It's in the times of my life where I have felt the comfort of, okay, everything's good, to be in the position where you are not stable, then that does allow for the growth. Thinking about when everything is hunky-dory and just everything is good, there's just not that same level of growth. Love that.
Yeah. So it isn't to suggest harmony does not exist. It's just saying that harmony has to be fleeting. Okay, that you can have those moments where there's harmony, but the harmony can't persist. The harmony has to be evolved. It has to be bettered. It has to be moved. And so to have consistent harmony, you have to have consistent disequilibrium to keep getting to new moments. And so you can have moments of bliss, you can have the highs, you can have a flow state,
yeah,
but you can't maintain that, because if you try to maintain that, then it doesn't work. It just collapses. What you want is that you want to undergo the you want to fall forward and then have another moment that's even better.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate all the tie-in to walking. I know that you've been doing a lot of walks, and so hopefully we'll get a chance to talk a little bit about that. But along those lines, what role do you think embodied questions, those we explore through doing rather than thinking, play in developing wisdom?
Yeah, explorers are questioners.
Mm.
What's on the other side of the hill? What happens if you go to the end? What's the origin of this? And so explorers, they do the questioning by examining and surveying and trying to go to the places that we don't know. So where we know has some stability, and they're going to head out to where there's instability, where there's the unknown, where there's unknown unknowns, and it's nothing but questions out there.
Yeah.
That's the instrumental part of what we do. We have two modes of being or living, or I would say two modes of betterment. Okay. One is where we are exploiting and perfecting what we do, where we take what we do and we make it better and better and better. And the other one is where we head into the unknown. We ask questions where we don't know anything. And that's the opposite. We're becoming less efficient. We drop the mandate of making things better, and we purposely go into things where we know this is going to be mostly failure and dead ends and inefficiencies and lost time. And so that's the cost of questions, is that most questions don't give you anywhere. They're dumb. You know, most questions are dumb questions, but you can't really tell until later. And so questioning is very inefficient. It's like the teacher is giving a lesson and they're interrupting. You have a question. So questions are not efficient. In the short term, most of them are dumb, and most of them are, I'm not going to lead anywhere, and they're diversions, and they're interruptions, and they're wasted effort, but you have to do them. In order to get to the great question, you have to have a bunch of dumb questions. So that mode of exploring, there's a kind of a ratio. With different people have different amounts. One is one-third exploration. Others say it's 20%. Mutations in biology are kind of exploration where most of them don't work, and it's in a couple percent. But the idea is that you have a smaller percentage of the explorations and the questioning compared to the exploitation, the perfecting. And it's like our rule of thumb in our own family is when we go out to eat, we have two dishes that we love and like the best dishes of the house. And we have one dish that we try, okay? Wow. And it's a little bit like a musician playing. Everybody wants to hear their classics. So I'll go two-thirds of the songs are what people want to hear, the old stuff, the good stuff. And then a third is the new stuff that might not work. So you can transfer that to lots of different things.
Wow. Yes, I love so many of those examples. How should one think about that line of questioning in one's life? Is that a good ratio? Because at this point, as I think on exploration, okay, yeah, for the most part, we know what's going on. There's not any new land to discover, plenty under the sea to discover. But in a day-to-day live in suburbia, how should we think about the exploratory, because most of the other is the efficiency that we're driving at, and most people are sitting in their cubicles paid to do.
Yeah, and also the contrary works is that you don't want to keep exploring. So a lot of people who like were dating, there was a rule of thumb for a while where you go after two-thirds of your allotted headspace for time, dating, whatever, you commit. You do the last third to commit. You spend two-thirds of the time exploring and a third trying to commit to it. So for some people, they struggle more with exploration. And that's particularly as you get older. It gets harder for people to explore and try stuff, in part because they have a little bit more wisdom about what works and doesn't work for them, in part because of laziness, in part because questioning and exploration is an investment in the long term. And if they're nearing the end of life, they say,
okay,
I don't need any more new friends. I'm going to better the current friends I have. And that's legitimate in some ways. But when you're young, you should certainly be spending a significant portion of your life questioning, exploring, trying stuff, taking risks, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, again, innovation is an art, are tremendously inefficient processes that require the acceptance of a lot of stuff that doesn't work, that isn't good, that you have to throw away. And part of this thing is getting comfortable with that. One of the things that a daily creative practice will teach you is that your well is bottomless if you do it daily. And that gives you greater ease at throwing stuff away because, hey, I get more tomorrow. I don't have to hold on to these ideas. I don't have to hold on to this stuff that I tried because I got more tomorrow. There's just, it's bottomless and I'll do it again. And so that ability to let go of things and try stuff and knowing that you're going to throw it away, knowing that you write a first draft of whatever it is and you're going to throw it away, knowing that you are making a prototype that you're going to throw away, knowing that you're going to build two in order to get one and throw that one away, that just becomes part of the process. And so you have to get comfortable with the idea that in that mode, a lot of the stuff will be thrown away.
That's a helpful reminder. Growing up where scarcity was a real thing, it was the, you don't expend the piece of paper, right? Every piece of paper counts. And so even now I struggle with, okay, that's easier in the electronic world, obviously now, but that's still that tape recorder is in the back of my head saying, oh, these resources are so limited.
Yeah, you want to get into the abundance mode rather than the scarcity mode. I mean, all creators must end up in the abundance mode at some point. I remember Condé Nast, who was the owners of Wired, who do the Vogue magazines and stuff, and he was celebrating the fact that they waste so much. He's celebrating wastage as a necessary ingredient of being really, truly at the edge of your best. And like you, I mean, I'm very thrifty in many ways, but that thriftiness can be overcome in many different ways. Digital is one example, but you can still have thriftiness even in digital, whether it's paying for AI tokens or whatever. You don't want to waste them. You do want to try and adopt an abundance mindset, because then you can be generous and then you can be free to, again, generate all the bad stuff that you need to generate in order to get to the good stuff.
That's lovely. I appreciate that. In the world of abundance, your 2017 book, The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future, you included a chapter on questions I really enjoyed, which included 15 statements that define what makes a quality question. Now we're in 2025. Is there anything that you would add to that list at all?
I don't think so. I mean, I probably should revisit in light of AI. AI has not yet gotten really good at asking questions. Occasionally, I'll ask an interesting question if you really press it. Mm-hmm. My sort of shorthand definition of a great question was one that produced as many new great questions as possible. In computer science, there's this concept of hill climbing. It's a visualization. It's a map, like a landscape map, like a mountain.
Okay,
where at
right.
the top of the mountain is perfection. And so you can imagine an organism climbing the steps to perfection over time, where it kind of becomes at the pinnacle of like a starfish for this particular niche. It's got everything perfect. It's at this peak. Or you can think of like a typewriter being developed. The Olivetti typewriter last when there was nothing more that you could do that would make it more perfect and suited to what it wanted to do. And that's called hill climbing. And often in mathematically in computer science, they said that the perfect answer is at the top, and they would sort of called gradient descent. The idea was, as long as you're going up in the right direction, you'll eventually get to the top because there's nowhere else to go. You just keep going up and up and up, and then you'll hit the top. And that's called hill climbing. That's exploitation. That's like, that's what the functions conceptually are doing, is you're trying to exploit and come to the top. And that's seen as a function of many things, and hill climbing is considered really good. If you have algorithms or devices or methods to help you come up to the peak of something, of perfection, you should be using it. But it's not the most powerful process. The most powerful process is not climbing the hill to the peak. It's making new mountains that are even taller than that hill. And then if you do make a mountain that's taller than the hill, you can get stuck on the peak. The lower peak is called a local optima versus a global optima. So an example would be Olivetti perfecting the typewriter, and then a new mountain was made called word processing, which was a bigger, had more users, bigger market. And Olivetti, their entire company, was pursuing excellence of the typewriter. And in order to get over to the word processing, they'd have to devolve.
Yeah.
They'd have to come down. They'd have to explore. They have to make stuff that's crap. And they weren't capable of that because they were pursuing excellence. There was no department of unexcellence. There was no department of devolution. There was no department of let's try stuff that's crap. Because that's the only way you're going to get over to the word processing. You have to go down, less fit, less optimized, stuff that doesn't work good, that's not worth the price. That's why only the startups would, because they didn't have any other choice but to be in that area where the market was non-existent. There was no market there. It's that valley of death. And so what that means is that sometimes success is imprisoning, that those who are most successful, if they're really truly pursuing excellence, they're all geared to climbing uphill. They can't climb downhill to get up to a bigger hill. But more importantly, that process of hill making is something that comes out of questioning. It's something that the hill making is, you're creating the new territory that you want to then optimize and explore. You know, like say AI art or something, it doesn't exist. It's like there's no market, there's no economics for it. It's totally an unknown, hazardous place to try and run a business. But those who do, they're making the hill, which will probably be a bigger hill than the art that we have by humans. But getting there is tough because there's dead ends, there's wastage, there's inefficiencies, there's small margins and no market. I mean, this is terrible for me. But will eventually be the bigger hill. And so this idea of being involved in hill making, of making a new territory, discovering a new territory, of creating a new territory, that's where the biggest gains are usually found.
Mm. I guess for a person, it's understanding what you're doing, because you can still, perfecting the typewriter can be a noble cause, right? And brings in income each day and puts food on the table.
And there's a beauty in it. And if you're a really good engineer, there's a certain incredible satisfaction and nobleness into making the very best machine for typing that's ever been made. There's nothing wrong with that. Trying to say, we need both functions. If you were looking for the biggest bang, you would head over into the new place. And one of the ways you can identify that is that there's no name for what it is that you're doing. Mm-hmm. So right now we are podcasting, but if we were doing this 20 years ago, you'd have a hard time explaining to your mom what it was you were doing.
Yes.
Well, it's kind of like radio, but it's not on the radio. And you would be out there by yourself in a certain way, ahead of the language. And so one of the things I tell young people for advice, if you want to be in the hill making at the frontier, get involved in something where there's no language, there's no name for what it is that you're doing, where it takes 20 minutes to explain to your parents what it is you're actually doing. That's a good sign that you're at the frontier, if that's where you want to be.
You've spoken before about the technological evolution.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a qualitative difference between the questions humans are asking and the questions our AI systems are beginning to formulate?
That's a fair question. Not that I've seen. What I've seen is only anecdotal.
Hmm.
I haven't seen any kind of a study on calibrating different kinds of questions. Right now, you can get AI to ask questions or to suggest questions, but they don't seem to me to be much different. Generally, the LLMs, their tendency is to head to the center, to be the average, to give you an average answer. And so they know a lot more. They know the super stuff. They know the edge cases, but you have to push them there. You have to nudge them. You have to force them. They're kind of like lazy interns. They're more capable. They'll just give you the easy answer first, and you have to kind of press. They're capable of doing better questions, but I haven't seen any kind of study. And my own anecdotal thing is that they're not much different.
What do you think would help them get there? If we say, okay, great, this is the new mountain, and LLMs, we need them to climb this mountain. Mm-hmm. Any idea on a forcing function on how we get them to ask the better questions so that they might improve in that direction?
A lot of people are working on this idea, and they want AI to be able to suggest a completely novel idea. I mean, basically, we're asking you to want questions that haven't been asked before. And there are a lot of people working on it, and we haven't had much success. The answer is we don't know how to do that. I think where we're headed to is kind of like intelligence. It's not an element, it's a compound. We have multiple kinds of AIs that are interacting and codependent on each other. So you have like an ecosystem of AIs, which is what we have in our own heads.
Yeah.
And so you need a little bit of that kind of recursive, strange loop stuff to get it to ask questions that haven't been asked before. And I think that's where people are working on, researchers are working on now, is combining different kinds of cognitive thinking to try to make a more complicated intelligence that would be capable of asking novel questions. It hasn't happened yet.
So is it fair to say that, based on what you had mentioned previously, that we need to drive to the inefficient such that it can learn out of it? We go to that unexplored area, we get super inefficient,
right?
And then out of that, we can grow towards building our new mountain, which is new questions, and then we can climb the mountain on that path.
Yeah, I think that's it. Though, again, in order to have a good question, it probably has to generate thousands of stupid questions. And then we need someone to evaluate some function to go through to recognize the good question. That's the frontier of AI. And it's not just about questions. It's about having novel insight. It's about having novel theories. And a lot of people are very interested in making that happen.
Gotcha. Shifting to your work with the Long Now Foundation, what were some novel questions that broke your brain at the time in thinking about this 10,000-year clock or beyond? How were questions a critical part of that thinking for you?
We built this clock that's ticking for 10,000 years inside a mountain. And one of the immediate questions it kind of promoted was, what's it good for? Like, if you had a clock for 10,000 years, what would you use it for? And then what else could you do over the long term for 10,000 years? I think the kind of questions that I began to think about was, how do you transmit value over time? And part of it was, how do you maintain values that don't change? How do you evolve values that need to change? And how do you make a difference? And how do you have two different regimes for the things that you don't want to change? And how do you even know what you don't want to change? So there's a million questions that come up thinking long term. So like, you want some kind of continuity. You want a civilization to have continuity. That's part of the definition. But what do you want to continue? What's the most essential aspects of our civilization that we don't want to go away? People have kind of first approximation, different answers, but we don't really have that wired anywhere. We don't have that encoded in a way that we could transmit or put into an artificial culture or our own culture. And so these basic things that we assume and take for granted have never really been examined. And so, like ethics, once we started making self-driving cars, we realized, well, we need to put into some kind of moral guidance on, you know, the trolley problem.
Yeah.
Right. If there, should the car swerve to protect the passengers, or should it give priority to protecting the pedestrian? And we've never demanded an answer for ourselves from that. And right now we just kind of wave our hands and say, well, I don't know, I will do my best. And that's not good enough for our AI-driven cars. We actually have to make them better than us. We have to have better morality answers than we have. And it's actually not hard to wire in the moralities into AIs. What's hard is actually deciding what it is. Yeah. What are the rules? What is the system? Because we give ourselves a pass. We don't think about it that hard. So that process of distilling something down, then we can transmit it over time, are questions I never even thought about before the long narrow came along. And I began to think about these issues of how you pass things along in time and not change the ones you don't want to change, and make sure you change the ones that are more adaptable so they can adapt. Because the converse is that we want to have the future generations have as much freedom of choice and more options than we have. Yeah. We don't want to bind them into something. We're reducing what they have, and they have to do what we want to do. That's kind of imprisonment of the future. So you have this weird thing of wanting to balance the things that you feel should not be changed with enough freedom to change everything else. And I'd never thought about that before. Just even trying to figure out what is it that we don't want changed is tough. And then how do you transmit those values over time, over thousands of years, or even 10 generations for that matter?
What do you think about questioning itself as an art form?
Yeah. I guess you could say fabulous interviewers, Terry Gross, questioning is an art form. You know, Lex Fridman, Tim Ferriss, they've made questioning an art form.
To me, it is majestic when just the right questions are asked to be able to expose, or not expose in a bad way, but just kind of take you into that new frontier a bit. How has being a photographer influenced the way you question reality visually compared to verbally?
You can be, there's a little bit of a bifurcation in the photographer. Are you a photographer that takes photos or makes photos? And I'm much more on the taking side of discovering them rather than inventing them. Conceptually, there's no real difference between inventing and discovering. But there is a little bit of to the first approximation, there's a difference. And so I like to walk around trying to discover the images. I'm making them to, in some ways, in terms of the composition. But for me, the question is kind of exploration. I'm exploring them to see what is there, and then I'm going to capture that. And there are other kinds of photography where you are much more in the making mode, where you're making things, you're directing it, you are composing it from scratch. You're much more engaged in the altering things. So the question that I have in photography is, what will happen? What will happen next? What will happen? And I will hang around an area, or I have a sense that there's something promising in that direction. Or if I stay here and wait, something interesting will happen. So I'm very much in the kind of the exploratory mode, the what if. What if we wait? What if we go further? Just, and that's the question I'm asking, is what might happen next? Other photographers will have a different kind of question that they're asking.
I've got your book set on Asia here, and it's been amazing to just go page after page. So now it'll be fun to go back and go through based on that definition.
Yeah, yeah.
Taking versus kind of curating and making.
So what you're mentioning is I did this 3-volume opus of my 50 years of travel in Asia in remote places, documenting the traditions and ceremonies that are disappearing. And for each one of those, I am standing there behind the lens. And I got there at the right moment, with a lot of time, wasting a lot of time waiting for something to happen, or walking down many dead-end streets hoping that something was there and it wasn't. So this was an incredibly inefficient process. Even though I had a pretty good nose for where things would happen, there was this incredible amount of time wasted, images you don't see, dead ends, stuff that didn't happen. So I often will remind people that in some ways that book, even though I don't use artificial lighting or anything, is kind of like a lie, because that's not what it looks like on average. That's not the world. This is an incredibly selected view, incredibly curated view of that world. And it required a huge amount of stuff you don't see that was thrown away, including hours and hours and hours and hours of riding on the back of a bus or waiting for something to happen that didn't happen. And so, yeah, it represents a kind of exploration that hides all the dead ends.
Kind of bouncing back and forth between working within the efficiency. For all that you've accomplished, you've mentioned so many times through this conversation about how you've been inefficient,
right,
in ways. And so I appreciate the reality of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I look at all that you've accomplished and I'm like, dang, this guy must have been like, you know, drinking 12 cups of coffee every day to get all this stuff done. But time and time again here, as you've talked through, it's like, no, you've taken time.
Yeah.
You've used it.
Again, I go back to this, you know, people talk about the daily practice. I'm a slow writer. I'm a reluctant writer. I don't like to write. But you make a book by writing little bits over long periods of time. It's sort of like Warren Buffett's advice for investing. It's like ordinary returns accumulated over extraordinary lengths of time will yield amazing profits. Like you just 1%, but you just compound 1% over long periods of time. So that's the long view. So the long view is that you do something on every day, and they have something called deliberate practice, which is the idea that you're just not repeating things, but you're trying to be a little bit better each time. And that every day is going to produce something wonderful over the long term, over months, maybe years. So yeah, we tend to overestimate what we can get done in 6 months and underestimate what we can get in 10 years. And so I seem to be willing to take the 10-year horizon, and then you can get things, you can make a dent because you've thrown away enough stuff that the good stuff looks pretty cool, but it's, you know, but yeah, it's 1 out of 100. You know, I did daily art. I did a little daily art, which I was posting every day for a year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe 10 of them were really great. So I did 10 really great images, but actually I did 365 images, and that's one of the reasons why we're in this renaissance of documentaries and movies, is because it's become so easy to make really bad ones. Mm-hmm. The reason why TV was not that productive making Shakespeare's was because it was so expensive. You couldn't afford to have bad TV. It was mediocre TV. But what you want is you want to have the freedom to have lots and tons of really bad stuff to get the real genius stuff. And so now with YouTube, anybody can make it. So there's tons and tons of bad stuff, but also we're getting the genius stuff too.
Right.
And so for me, quantity is really important for quality. It's very, very important. Quantity is necessary for quality. And by the way, I mean, there's lots of things about that. One, I think that's why you need kind of a minimum population to produce great things. I mean, okay. I have a concern with the population implosion happening, but there's some number, which you don't know what it is, of a minimum number of people that you need to get the level of goodness of stuff and infrastructure and everything else. It's just hard to afford quality things if there isn't a sufficient critical mass of people to support it,
right?
Not just inventing it, but just keep it going economically and all this other stuff. So I'm really a believer in the quantity route to quality.
Beautiful. Now, I'd like to ask folks, what is their right now question? So this is between what is for lunch and who you're going to get married to. What are your right now questions that you are wrestling with or working with in your life?
Well, personally, I have two different things I spend a lot of time on. One is writing these conceptual things, and the other one is making art. And I wrestle with how much time to spend on more on art or more on the writing. Maybe it's not really clear. So my goal, my star that I'm aimed at is to not be the best, but to be the only, to do things that only I can do. And so I do ask myself a lot of, can someone else do what I'm trying to do here? And part of that is like, am I more me in doing my art or more me in doing the writing? And it's not clear, and I might just have to continue to do both, but that, you know, switching from one to another, I switch like during the day a lot, and that gets me happy, but I do ask myself, should I be doing more writing or should I be doing more art?
Well, that's the beauty of questions, is you get to keep wrestling with the answers. As we move towards wrapping up, do you have any other thoughts or encouragements about questions that we haven't explored? It's probably 10,000, but if we necked it down...
In my chapter on questions in The Inevitable, I think I concluded with the idea that going forward, if you want an answer, you're going to ask a machine, and that the skill for the time being that humans will have was getting a good question. If you want a good answer, ask a machine. If you want a good question, ask a human. And so this is this idea that in schools, we should be teaching kids to ask better questions rather than getting answers, because I've seen some young people live with an always-on AI. Very, very uncanny when you have an always-on and they're having this ongoing conversation with the AI constantly. And I think that's where we're headed. Getting answers for everything all the time. And so learning how to ask questions, I think maybe we'll start to teach in schools, or maybe we'll emphasize that. Maybe we'll understand more about it. As you can see, I don't think there's very much of a science around it. I haven't seen a lot of research on what makes a good question? How do you ask a good question? All these kinds of things. So perhaps somebody out there who has a bent in that direction would pick this up as a research project. And neurobiologically, there's the how do we do it? And there's culturally, how do we do it? So maybe this could be a whole new discipline. Questionology.
Yes. I am all about that future.
Right.
Indeed. Kevin, where's the best place for folks to engage with you and learn more about all that you're excited about?
My initials is my website, kk.org. Everything I do goes up there. On the socials, I am Kevin2Kelly, the number two, Kevin2Kelly. I have a little free weekly newsletter called Recommendo 1M that's a one-pager that recommends six cool stuff, six cool things, six cool recommendations every week. Sign up for free. And my latest book was called Excellent Advice for Living, which had like 450 modern proverbs, which you might enjoy.
Indeed. I know that every Sunday morning, I look forward to Recommendo, and I highly encourage anyone listening to just follow anything and everything Kevin is doing. So Kevin, thank you so very, very much for being a part of the questioning community. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And there you go. I had been looking forward to the possibility of this conversation since 2019 when I started the podcast, and Kevin delivered rich insights. I pulled the following four takeaways from my notes, and I'd love to hear what resonated most with you. Number one, questions as drivers of growth. Throughout the interview, Kevin discusses how questions create a state of disequilibrium. This, quote, slightly off balance dynamic isn't something to avoid, but rather to embrace as a life force that drives evolution, innovation, and personal growth. Just as walking is a controlled fall forward, intellectual advancement requires the constant imbalance that thoughtful questioning provides. Question: what questions do you dwell on to be in purposeful imbalance? Number two, the wasteful nature of good questions. This one hit close to home, and I should have camped out on this insight longer with Kevin. He repeatedly emphasizes that inefficiency is essential to valuable questioning. He explains that most questions are dumb and that exploration is inherently inefficient. Yet this apparent wastefulness enables breakthrough discoveries. This counterintuitive perspective challenges our productivity-obsessed culture by suggesting that the path to true innovation requires accepting and even going as far as celebrating the dead ends and wasted effort that come with exploration. His personal examples from photography to writing demonstrate how an abundance mindset that accepts waste ultimately produces quality. Question: what is your practice in embracing the inefficient nature of questions to achieve breakthroughs? Number three, questions as, quote, hill making. Kevin uses the metaphor of hill climbing versus hill making to differentiate between optimizing existing ideas, or climbing, and creating entirely new paradigms, making new hills. He explains that the most significant innovations don't come from perfecting existing systems, but from the messy, inefficient progress of creating entirely new possibilities. Questions are essential to the hill making process that leads to revolutionary change. Working with the Long Now Foundation on the 10,000-year clock, Kevin has considered making new hills. Question: what are the new hills you can build and frontiers you can explore? And number four, human-AI complementarity. Kevin suggests AI excels at providing answers, yet humans still maintain the unique ability to formulate truly novel questions. A future where machines provide answers while humans offer questions. He observes that current AI systems tend toward averages and center thinking, making them less capable of the kind of innovative questioning that drives human advancement. Question: How can you use your curiosity and humanity to pursue questions that trend toward the fringes? That's it. And to those on the other side of the speakers, thank you for being here. I trust Kevin's optimistic and abundant viewpoint has extended the boundaries of your questions. Gratitude shout out to Beauty Pill for the show's music and producer Ben Ford for the technical help. This episode was recorded on Piscataway land. Please engage with this episode in some manner. Download, follow, save, like, share, or comment about something that resonated, as I mentioned at the top. This action ensures we are engaging the questioning community. Until next time, keep questioning.